Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you so much to Chanduko for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. We kick off this particular Wednesday with yet another weird law from around the world. This one comes to you courtesy of Lesotho, so fairly close to home. Up until the Legal Capacity of Married Persons Act of 2006, women in Lesotho were considered children in the eyes of the law. They were beholden to their husbands in all legal and financial matters. The legislation was, of course, introduced in 2006, and since 2006, things have been different. You're tuning to the SAFM Market Update with Maniwe, but on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the water tanker mafia conversation that we couldn't get to yesterday. We're going to be speaking to the Water Institute of Southern Africa and getting a sense of the seriousness of this particular situation and what it is that we can do about it. Then we've got a conversation taking a look at stolen South African credit cards and how they make their way onto the dark web. We're going to speak to the editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, about that and get a sense of how to protect ourselves from that. Then we have a conversation with the team at Nedbank taking a look at the latest around sustainability efforts, especially as we get closer to the G20 and what is being done under the B20. And then because it is Wednesday, we do have an executive lounge conversation. We're going to be speaking to the managing partner of Sterling Bell, Leon Ayo. We're going to be getting to know him a little bit better beyond his day-to-day responsibilities.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we start off the show with market conversations and a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Sasfin Wealth's David Shapiro to take a look at market movements and see what you make of them. Uncle David, lovely having you on the show as always. Always lovely to catch up. The Rand, 17 Rand 10. Mm. That's a nice number.
Well, it's a combination of a lot of factors. I think coming off the grey list is certainly an issue, but I think, Jimmy, what's interesting, today we had a very good, strong market, mining market. You know, up to now it's been gold and platinums that have really driven that market higher and responsible for pushing the all share index into its present territory, which is all-time highs and strong. But suddenly today, things are shifting much more towards the diversified miner. The iron ore price has picked up. We've seen a strong move in copper prices. So you're getting Glencore and Anglos and Billiton and the larger miners now also starting to contribute. Now, I don't know if this is long term. Certainly the Mr. Trump's visit to China is easing tensions and perhaps opening the way for growth and especially with addressing tariffs and perhaps lowering them to give the world a chance to grow. So we've seen some good markets in miners, and Glencore was one of the big movers today. And yet, you know, if you looked at their production reports, it wasn't great, but it's their outlook, what they're seeing ahead, and the positioning of the companies that saw them up 7%. So it's a nice, you know, this is much more, what's the word, you know, stronger for the local market. It's much more substantial than maybe gold and platinum, which can be extremely volatile. So good move today. So we are up. The rest of the market down, you know, the financials and retailers, but they've been a bit patchy, you know, erratic, but still overall a good market.
Uncle David, you bring up Glencore, and I think I remember having a look at this when we were looking at some of the performances of the other mining companies, and Glencore year to date was one of the worst performing companies from a stock return perspective. It's nice to see that they're coming back. It's nice to see that all of the market participants are starting to find a bit of favor. Do you think it has anything to do with, and you alluded to this, around the fact that with President Trump striking up all the deals that he seems to be striking up, South Korea, Japan, everybody except China at this point, and the China deal is set to take place tomorrow as well, do you think that's what markets are looking at from an optimism point of view?
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt. And it's just, you know, there's a better feel globally. and more confidence coming in. You might not see it in the indices or the gauges at the moment, but you can certainly feel it from commentary, from discussions that are taking place. Just on your Glencore, you're dead right. It's only up about 1.5% for the whole year, against what's at 30% for the all share index. But I mean, it has come back from a very oversold position. But Anglo's is up and so on. But Anglo's up 23%. What other? I'm just looking at BHP is up only 8.7%. But this is a big change. But I think, I've been watching. I'm not a Trump favorite, openly. I'm not his greatest fan, but you can't take away from him, from this travel around, and he loves it. People are all over him, adoring fans, should I say, and shaking his hands and so on, and him showing off. So, but I must say, it's had an impact from Japan. Lovely. You see the meeting there through to South Korea, and as you say, he wouldn't make these noises about China if this wasn't preconceived. If it hasn't been prearranged, so he's not going to go in there and be made a fool of. So I think all these deals with Nvidia, and Nvidia's and the other story. There's every minute I want to say another deal. Jimmy, they've got a market cap now of over $5 trillion. Now convert that even at 17 at the improved rand, that's $85 trillion market cap. I was trying to look up the GDP or the wealth of South Africa. How much income do we generate, or how much production do we generate? And it comes to about 6 billion rand, versus 85 billion of so it gives you an idea of just how big Nvidia is. But they're good for it. Once global markets are up, it follows through here. If there's a good feel in the world markets, we feel it.
Speaking of things that will hopefully follow through into the South African and global markets, we have an interest rate decision coming out of the United States in a couple of, well, in less than 2 hours, actually, at 8 o'clock. We've also got a Fed statement, an FOMC statement that'll pair that and give us an indication of what it is that the US Fed is thinking about. We're expecting a 25 basis point rate cut. Is it all but certain at this point?
I think so. I think the one thing that can pop Mr. Trump's bubble is Mr. Powell. Don't think Mr. Trump hasn't had a go at old Powell while he was in Japan. I've been giving him insults and so on. But they have nominated, I think, five people who could take over from Powell. But Mr. Powell can say, well, let's see who's boss, and come out, even though he's going to reduce rates, come out with, say, a hawkish or a statement ahead. In other words, saying, well, it's not so sure we're going to reduce rates down the line, so he can pop Mr. Trump's bubble, but I don't think he's going to do that. We haven't got stats out, so it's been very difficult. So he's also been flying blind, although I think he's got a much better feel than most people about where the US economy is. But we will get that rate cut, yeah.
Uncle David, we are also expecting that ECB President Christine Lagarde will give comments from her perspective about an hour and a half or so after the Fed announcements. Is there anything we're looking at from Europe's perspective? I mean, they have been relatively quiet, and that's only to say that the United States has been much louder than every other country at this point.
I don't think anything we're expecting anything from them. Funny enough, it's they've held okay. I'm invested. I mean, we look at Europe very carefully, particularly from a consumption point of view, production point of view. So I'm trying to think it through, whether or not a lot of investors are saying Europe's cheap, time to switch there. It's steady. It's steadying out. That's true. But I don't think it could catch up with the US. The more I look at artificial intelligence and I look at the companies that are coming through, that apart from ASML, which is and a few Dutch companies, which hold their own. But overall, I don't think they can keep pace with the US. The US is still, for its size, I mean, it's from a population point of view, It's only what's over 300 million or thereabouts. It's small relative to other big countries, but it punches above its weight in terms of the economy. But I still think that it's still the dominant market and the dominant economy. A lot of work for the others, for certainly for Europe and UK to catch up. And where's he looking at now? He's looking east, Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Korea, Japan, China. So Europe's got to get out of its history and start looking forward. I always call it a historical theme park,
Well, the historical theme park that is the European Union will have to come back to us with some information and some insights around what it is that the markets can expect from them. But for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Uncle David for those insights and for the time. David Shapiro of Sasfin Wealth joining us to take a look at market movements, overall market sentiment, and some of the interesting developments that have been happening that have been fueling market gains.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
We can stay here, stick with what worked before, keep our eye on that one spot, steadfast. Or we can recognize that the only constant is change. At 91, we believe that with change comes opportunity. That's why we have 250 investment professionals in the world's investment hubs actively seeking opportunities for you, wherever in the world they may be. Isn't it time to change how you see investing? Invest offshore with 91. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've been hearing the term water tanker mafias of late, and it seems as though this problem is not necessarily a new one, but certainly one that does need to be addressed. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail and trying to make sense of what exactly is going on here and how exactly we can address the problem. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa, Dr. Lester Goldman, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Dr. Goldman, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The South African Human Rights Commission has stated that, in their view, the water tanker mafia damage, or the damage to water infrastructure that's being done, should be treated as terrorism in the country and should be dealt with legally from that perspective. Clearly, that means that this problem is an exceptionally serious one.
Yes, Jimmy, and good afternoon to the listeners. Yes, sir. For the layman understanding the water tank issue, it's like imagining a house with a leaking roof. And instead of fixing the roof, the owner keeps buying buckets and pays people to stand under the drips, empty the buckets and move them as the leaks spread. This is exactly what's happening with the water tankers at municipal level. It doesn't make sense. We need to stop paying indefinitely for these proverbial buckets. We need to fix and secure our infrastructure. Look, amongst others, water tank mafias appear to be criminal organizations that disrupt water service delivery so that they can provide water tanker services at an inflated cost to municipalities. So they are therefore destroying state property and depriving communities of a constitutional right for personal gain. And I think that's the comment from the SA Human Rights Commission. We sit with a further problem that how do these mafias even know that they will win such water delivery tenders once supply is disrupted, unless they are working with corrupt individuals within the municipalities? So we sit with a double whammy in that we are spending a lot of money and we're still dealing with what appears to be either collusion or corruption, within municipalities.
Dr. Goldman, you mentioned the fact that this effectively could be part of an inside job, and that's what's causing this, the rise of the mafia. But that's not the root cause of the problem. I want to take a look at the infrastructure side of it, because for many, many years in South Africa, we've had the problem of not maintaining infrastructure as we should. And I want to take a look at that and perhaps the impact that could have on the disruptions that we're seeing today.
Absolutely. If we look at some root causes to this challenge, and when I say challenge, it's not only necessarily water tankers or water tanker mafia. There are also other service providers that provide essential infrastructure maintenance and so forth to municipalities. And they may also be a part of the problem in terms of vandalizing or not necessarily maintaining the infrastructure as it should be. Root causes, I think, to look at, certainly procurement frameworks, procurement design, because it allows, you know, these sometimes long-term operational contracts for emergency services. And so the question is, would be such emergency services without performance-linked contracts or without strict caps or limitations are already a red flag, Then weak oversight and fragmented accountability across municipal departments, also state-owned utilities. There should be some form of oversight over this. It's absolutely unacceptable that reactive excuses are being made. So, you know, weak oversight is a problem or root cause. And then we have financial pressure and short-term budgeting that doesn't appear to be linked or aligned to best practice because it seems to favor these pay-as-you-go, stopgap emergency types of spending over the capital investment you mentioned earlier. Very likely a root cause, criminal networks that infiltrate and exploit these governance gaps, you know, by sabotaging infrastructure, for example, or creating artificial scarcity. And I must say then there's also poor community participation and a lack of transparent data on such things. Because if communities are involved and there was more transparency, there was more information about these issues, surely there'd be more proactive decision making.
Dr. Goldman, how do we start to deal with this problem? Because we've seen in markets like the construction space, where we've heard of things like the construction mafia as well in that space, it actually halts the progress of things being done and services being delivered. And in the case of water, we can ill afford to have communities without running water or communities being forced to pay for water at rates that don't make sense. So how do we deal with this?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's sad that communities are the ones that suffer. And ironically, it often appears to be the most vulnerable of communities that suffer. So that's seriously not acceptable. I think, you know, some practical mitigations and solutions, and I don't think there's an easy solution to this, because we appear to be dealing with problems or challenges emanating from individuals either acting in collusion to commit fraud and corruption, and or individuals of the communities and so forth that are part of this whole thing. So it's difficult to pinpoint or identify who, where, how and why. But certainly just from a general perspective, we can look and say, look, the first thing we need to look at to mitigate is governance and procurement reforms. So municipalities need to enforce emergency-only rules and the oversight that goes with it. Then again, competitive, transparent tendering. I think this will ensure a little bit more accountability and ensure oversight. We're not saying water tankers shouldn't exist, but we're saying if there was more transparency in the allocation of such, it certainly would assist in this regard. And then break single supplier dominance. I mean, how is it possible that some individuals can, go and seemingly purchase multi-million rand tankers and projects on the basis of emergency type of services? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense from a feasibility perspective. So that's governance and procurement reforms. I think certainly technical and operational solutions need to be looked at. And this is where we talk about municipalities must target capital repairs, you know. Use your money to fix the infrastructure. Don't use your money to address the symptoms, which is the tankers and so forth. They can deploy remote monitoring, alarm systems and as such to detect when there's vandalism or tampering. And simple little things like GPS track deliveries and so forth on the tankers will allow them to ensure that there's some form of effectiveness and efficiency and transparency when they are being invoiced. Anti-sabotage and security measures, these are issues that even we do in our homes. CCTV, secure pumping stations, community watch agreements, and many of them have security companies and or security divisions within municipalities. Surely they should be involved, as well as other law enforcement, because if we're dealing with terrorism, then surely the security cluster needs to be involved. And then I think lastly, just in terms of this financial and planning measures, ring fence your budgets. Only allocate a certain portion for emergency type of spending. Use the rest for capital repair funds, as it should be. And then use short-term blended finance if need to address the lack of capital, specifically looking at the asset infrastructure.
Water remains an essential part of human life, and protecting the supply of water is everybody's responsibility, especially in these times. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to That was the Chief Executive Officer of the Water Institute of Southern Africa, Dr. Lester Goldman, joining us to take a look at dealing with South Africa's water crisis.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It seems South African credit cards, particularly those that have been stolen, are gaining popularity on the dark web. We're going to be taking a look at this in a little bit more detail and trying to make sense of it. I'm joined on the line by editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, to see if we can get our heads around this. Jan, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. I've always known about credit cards being sold in bulk on the dark web and those sorts of conversations, but I've never thought that South African credit cards would make it that far.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of, and good evening, in terms of how much the price of each one has increased in the past 2 years, according to new research by NordVPN. The price has gone up from... I'm going to give it in rands, even though they've done it in dollars, because obviously that's probably going to be the currency in which they're priced on the dark web. So on average, a South African credit card cost in 2023, 69 rand and 98 cents. So let's call it 70 rand. That has increased by almost 64% to 114 rand and 45 cents, almost, just shy of 114 rand and 50 cents over there. And so they say that that's purely driven by supply and demand, which is driven by, in turn, how difficult the cards are to come by, how useful they are, how much money they can earn for criminals. But to also put that in perspective, that's still below the global average of 100, and let's call it 38 rand. So, ours is 114 rand. The global average is 138. And the highest, most expensive credit card in the world is a Japanese card, and they sell for around 393 rand each. We kind of fall once again in a comfortable middle there, which is really not where you want to be. It's kind of the industry norm. It's, you know, same kind of situation for the United States and so on. It was truly enlightening to see this research from NordVPN about, you know, just how much the credit card thieves earn relative to the pain they inflict on the people whose card details they steal at the end of the day.
Yeah, and let's take a step back here and just clarify. We are not talking about legitimately purchased credit cards. We're not talking about approved credit cards that go through your bank. We're talking about people stealing your credit card information and selling it to someone else. How does this all work in the dark web?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, there's the theory and then there's the down to practice, right? Like, how do the card details get stolen in the first place? And there's multiple ways. Card skimmers and card cloning devices, where they literally scan the details available from your card from the magstripe, is one popular way to do it. Another way is to actually just hand copy them down. There's a practice in the car rental industry, for example, where they take an imprint of your credit card, which there needs to be a better way for that, because that's asking for these card details to become exposed, and those are very like simple everyday examples of how these card details get stolen at the end of the day, and then those get collated into databases and traded on the dark web. Then from there, it has to go through various next steps before they're actually exploited. The next step is verification, making sure that the card is indeed active, valid, and does have money on it to be stolen. Then there's sort of the more technically advanced ways in which card details are stolen, but that's usually like a one and done type situation, where you type your credit card details into a website, you've perhaps followed a link without thinking, or somehow ended up on an attack site that looks exactly like the checkout page for, you know, whatever, you know, Woolworths or Take a Lot or Checkers or whatever the case might be, and you type in your credit card information, and then they get quickly stolen in the back, and the attacker steals money off of it. So there's various ways in which these work, and each one slightly different from the rest.
Jan, when you said car rental companies, it took me back to the actual machine. I can visualize the actual little handheld machine that cards get placed on, and then they almost get ironed over, and that,
right.
Wow, we need to come up with better systems from that. Jan, how do people stay safe? This clearly is a problem. It clearly is going to be something that's going to be around for a while, and I can't imagine that those that are stealing the cards are intending to stop. So how do we protect ourselves?
Right. So besides the regular standard advice for protecting your card details, which includes never let your card leave your site. So, even though SANRAL has, you know, denied its toll booth operators being routinely involved in this, there is anecdotal evidence of people saying, you know, every time that they hand over their card detail in a toll booth, something tends to happen. Now, we actually use those facilities often, and it has happened, but it's rarely happened that our card details get stolen that way. But that is one way, because you allow your card to leave your site. So we are seeing mass rollouts of tap to pay machines at toll booths, and those are incredibly welcome. But that's one example of where your card leaves your site. And the standard advice from banks is, do not let your card leave your site. Be wary of card skimming and cloning devices. We've got images of those up in historical articles on the website, what to look out for, then use virtual cards where possible. Now, those virtual cards can take various forms. FNB has a very famous virtual card system, but they're not the only bank with virtual cards. Even these Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, Google Pay type systems essentially virtualize your card. Now, they're not perfect, but it introduces just another barrier for that criminals have to break in order to actually use a stolen card. So using those digital payment systems actually, and the virtual card facility available from your bank, really helps protect your details at the end of the day. And then NordVPN has provided more advice, which is monitor your statements regularly. And the second you see something out of the ordinary, flag it with your bank. And then standard password advice. Use strong passwords. Don't duplicate passwords. Use multi-factor authentication. Then you can also take the extra step of signing up to a dark web monitoring service. But that obviously costs money. Not everybody will necessarily take that step, but that is an option available to folks who want to be extra cautious about their credit card details.
Yeah, and you mentioned that digital cards are safe, and I wonder just how safe they are with all of the tap-and-go features we have and all of the wearables and the wallet functionalities that we have. Because for some people, you can just effectively place your phone against something or your wearable against something, and because of NFC technology, it sometimes doesn't even verify the transaction. It just goes through. Doesn't that leave us more exposed to card skimmers?
Counterintuitively, less. Look, it depends on the exact device. I'm in the Apple ecosystem. So when I use my iPhone to pay, it will not, it actually introduces an extra layer of security, which is biometrics. So for me to actually tap my phone to pay, I have to bring up there's like a shortcut to bring up the wallet, but then it has to use Face ID to authenticate that before it will let me pay. Now, that is not available on a standard NFC card. If you, for example, lose your bank card, your tap to pay bank card, there's no face ID on that. There's the standard bank security systems on that, which is they'll ask for your PIN over a certain amount. They'll randomly ask for the PIN, you know, after a certain number of transactions and so on. So they do secure that in a different way. But these digital systems are much safer, actually, even though they for some people it might feel less safe, they're much safer. And then, you know, I know on the Apple Watch, for example, people are like, yeah, but, you know, what if the watch gets stolen off your wrist or whatever? The second the watch leaves my wrist, it locks, and it will not unlock unless I unlock it.
Staying safe is imperative in the digital age that we live in, and that is probably the best way to counteract the credit card theft that we're seeing happen in the market. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Jan for those insights and for the time. Jan Vermeulen, editor at MyBroadband, joining us to take a look at credit card theft and the credit cards that are being sold on the dark web.
I think it's time for an adventure. We could visit the grandkids, check on a London apartment while we're there, or we could meet them in Dubai and look at properties along the way.
Why settle in one place when you can be a global citizen? If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker who will connect your global banking, lending, and investments on a single platform. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you by Nedbank, leaders in renewable energy finance. As we draw closer to the G20 summit, we have been seeing that conversations around the efforts of the G20 and of other affiliated setups such as the B20 continue. And we're going to be taking a look at this, and we're going to be taking a look at how we can ensure sustainable future for South Africa and indeed the African continent. I'm joined on the line by the executive head for sustainability at Nedbank, Bridget Burnett, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Bridget, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. With all the conversations happening around the G20 and the B20, a lot of the conversations are centered around making sure that we have long-term partnerships and making sure that we change the way things are being done. How does that line up with some of the commitments that we're starting to see from the various stakeholders and from those that are participating in these conversations?
I think that's really spot on in terms of just what we've seen coming out as maybe a new currency, and that is collaboration and how to really work in partnership across various sectors within our economy to reshape what our economy looks like. And the G20 and B20 have really sort of provided a framework for turning a lot of talk over the decades about access, about transition, about affordability into real tangible and progress and improvements in lives and livelihoods and building economies. And it really is important to sort of find that collaboration in bringing these frameworks into life and putting these aspirations into practice.
Now, Bridget, over many, many years now, Nedbank has almost secured its reputation as the green bank. And that's not because of the color of the bank necessarily, but more around the sustainability efforts of the bank over many, many years and some of the areas of finance that the bank has chosen to actively pursue. How do we then look at organizations like Nedbank and other banks as potential collaborators, as you mentioned, and how do we find their place in the ecosystem that is this collaboration, this collaborative world?
Yeah, I think that as a player in the finance sector, we really are the intermediary, and we can sort of bring together what sort of policy changes would be required, but we could help sort of facilitate what entry points there could be across the full value chain of the sector. So I think that we've looked at partnerships, particularly where we cannot address some of those changes directly through our financing opportunities. And we've looked at partnering, for example, with organizations such as WWF to help us understand the needs in the bioeconomy. So I think that there are very many different entry points depending on where you come in from the value chain. So at Nedbank, we would have a look at sort of foundational funding, we look at pre-commercial funding, then we look at building up small businesses and try and create a sort of pipeline of opportunities that eventually land up in like large-scale renewable opportunities. So there are different entry points depending on where you are in that value chain and how one would partner.
Bridget, let's take a look at the strategy behind the capital deployment. I mean, I'm thinking back to a couple of years ago, there was a concert in South Africa. It was the Global Citizens Concert. And alongside that, we were talking about sustainable development goals. And we have had these sustainable development goals as conversations throughout the last couple of years. Nedbank's been very active in that space. But how does that then start to translate from a strategic point of view when you start to look at the projects that you get involved in? Because a lot of the misconception is that these sustainable development goals and these conversations are merely just charitable conversations and not actually sustainable conversations. How do we start to shift that when we think about the strategy and how we deploy the capital?
Nedbank's purpose tries to encapsulate quite a lot of that, where we talk about using our financial expertise for good outcomes for all stakeholder groups. And we've actually chosen to reference the SDGs as descriptors of what those good outcomes would be, understanding that those are the key needs of all of humanity. And how we've tried to translate that into sort of strategic imperative is we've set ourselves a target that at least 20% of all our gross loans and advances need to be sustainable finance. So they need to be answering one or other of the SDGs that we know that it creates positive impact. So, and where that really matters most. So up until now, we've probably got about 189 billion in SDG linked financing. It's not really at all about charity. It's about strategy, it's about commercial purpose, and it's about value creation. We really do believe in creating value first, and profits will follow.
Bridget, how do you create value but also ensure that it is tangible in the real world? I mean, a lot of the conversations that have happened for some part, or at least to a certain degree, have been conversations that have been had at a high level, but the real world impacts haven't been felt. How do we start to look at sustainability conversations in the real world and make sure that we see visible impact?
I do think that the frameworks that we're getting, such as those that are coming out of G20 and B20, things like the SDGs, the Paris Agreement, at least give us sort of a universal North Star that we can work towards. And I think it's very important to also find what are the policy regulatory enabling environment changes that might be needed to enable that real world impact. And I think it's really incumbent on finance to also understand truly what is your client need. What is it that your client is needing in their own transition and in their sort of strategic intent, and then really financing that in a maybe uniquely South African or African solution, which acknowledges that we face not only climate change, biodiversity loss, we also have to look at employment, jobs, poverty alleviation. I think if you can bring all of those together, there will be real impact.
It's about making real impact and meaningful impact as we head towards the G20 conversations and the G20 summit that will indeed take place in the month of November. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Executive Head of Sustainability at Nedbank, Bridget Burnett, for joining us to take a look at the importance of sustainability and collaboration as we head forward. This interview was brought to you by Nedbank. Power progress with Nedbank, a proud sponsor of B20. As proud sponsors of the B20 Summit, Nedbank is at the forefront of Africa's energy transition. With 47 billion rand invested in renewable energy projects, Nedbank has financed 5 gigawatts of clean energy capacity. This proves that Nedbank doesn't just fund transformation, they fuel it by shining a light on Africa and its power. See money differently. Nedbank. Nedbank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Running a business can feel like a solo mission. I mean, you've got the hustle. If only your office Wi-Fi was your employee of the month. Turn on your success with Telkom Business, the partner that always shows up. Get a reliable 25 by 25 megabytes per second connection with Stream Connect Fiber for only 489 rands per month.
This summer, your business deserves the best. Visit telkom.co.za/business for deals that connect your business. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's executive lounge time on a Wednesday, and we are getting to know yet another executive a little bit better beyond their day-to-day responsibilities. This week's executive is the managing partner at Sterling Bell, also sitting on the advisory boards for the Johannesburg Business School, as well as the Africa Business Council, Leon Ayo. He joins me on the line now to get to know him a little bit better. Leon, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. How does a military man end up running a consulting firm?
Oh, well, great to be here, Jimmy. Thank you for that. Yeah, I think my military career ended 20 years ago. And when one looks back, I think we're quite naive when we go into the military when we're in our early 20s. But it's a great foundation and grounding in life. That's not commenting on perhaps how we view the geopolitical aspects of what we're involved in all those years ago. But it was a great grounding in leadership, working with people, high performance, you know, working in high stakes environments. And I think a lot of those lessons I've carried into my second career in consulting and one foot in academia.
Leon, why the balance? Why the split? What's the draw card towards academia and the draw card towards business?
It's interesting. I think the military is full of aspirational warrior poets. So we're all drawn to the adventure and the excitement. And then we realize we're in a very serious business that is very difficult, very draining. So a lot of people in the army have a short career and then take those lessons into the world of business. One thing I've realized is what the army does very well, and I'm talking about the British Army, was actually, it's one of the few organizations where they train you for the role you're going to do. So before I was put in charge of platoon, I had a year of selection, and then I had about 18 months actual training, and you're always well prepared for that role. And I found that in the commercial world, that isn't always the case. So I've tried to be involved in business schools for the last 20 years to prepare leaders, be they middle managers, newly appointed or senior executives, to really bring some of those lessons that we learn from having conversations with other leaders. A lot of it can be in a textbook, but actually most of it is from experiences and deep case studies.
Leon, as someone who's worked across many geographical locations and who runs businesses in and outside of South Africa, you've had the privilege of kind of getting a sense of different leadership styles and different cultures that influence those leadership styles. Do you think that there's value in having those worldly experiences as a leader, especially if you are looking to lead a large organization or build a new business?
I really do. And I think it is a privilege to have been had the opportunity to work on four continents, but most importantly, in different contexts. And I think the first lesson that I really learned was, having spent the early part of my career in the UK, I moved to South Africa when I was in my mid-30s. And what one thinks works in London doesn't necessarily work in Johannesburg. So it can be quite humbling. And this is where I think travel, exposure to different experiences and contexts humbles you and gives you the opportunity to really, really try and understand yourself better. So that emotional intelligence, that self-awareness, understanding how to work in a diverse context, you know, different languages, different cultural contexts. So that for me is the first real important lesson for an international leader. What works in one environment doesn't necessarily work in another.
Leon, what do you miss about the military?
So it's 20 years ago, and I must say today I don't miss too much. But again, I think it was great to be part of an organization that is clearly bigger than yourself, and you feel perhaps is there a force for good. I think my political views have changed as I've got older. I think the role of the military is essential, but I think it's a force of last resort, which we hopefully never really have to use. And I find business much more fulfilling in that, you know, one of the concepts of the military we had, we used a leadership model called John Adair's action-centered leadership model. And essentially that gives the organization time to train as an individual, then train as a team before you deploy on a mission. And what I've realized is in the world of business where I spent the last 20 years, you're always on mission. You're always operational. You're never really having time off. So as leaders, we've got to ensure that we can lead sustainably, driving performance, winning, but ensuring that people do get the rest and recuperation that is required.
Leon, of the four continents you've worked in, where would you say has been your favorite place to travel to?
Without doubt, working on the African continent is the most rewarding. I mean, for me, on a personal level, I'm of Anglo-Nigerian origins. My grandfather left Nigeria to fight in the Second World War, and I was raised in the UK. And I appreciate Africa is a large continent, much larger than some people realize, and it's not one homogenous place. But moving to South Africa, I think, gave me the opportunity to lead where it matters. I think the difference between perhaps working in Europe or even Saudi Arabia is the lack of jeopardy. I think as leaders in a South African and African context, and I've worked in Uganda, Zambia, working a lot in the DRC right now, what we do really matters because there isn't a huge social safety net. So if we fail as leaders, people lose their jobs and that has consequences that are very negative. On the contrary, when we succeed, we enable people to grow. And if we're delivering infrastructure projects, building hospitals, airports, that really can transform a nation. So I feel the jeopardy in Africa is really there compared to perhaps in the UK and in Saudi Arabia, where the consequences of failure are professional pride, but most people won't lose meals because of it.
Speaking of meals, Leon,
Yeah. You
have quite the interesting background from a heritage perspective. Has that influenced your palate at all?
I think definitely that the great jollof rice debate goes on. Is it Ghana or Nigeria? And I believe Kenya and South Africa are not allowed to participate in that debate. But I also do think being something of an outsider as you grow up, and I think I speak to other executives of mixed heritage, being mixed race, you know, you don't necessarily fit into one group, which I think makes you sit on the outside and be something of an observer, which can give you an advantage when you're coming into leader team. It can be lonely when you're growing up. It can be a great accelerant in terms of emotional intelligence. So never quite fitting in and always being an outsider. And then when you get to my age of 47, you realize it doesn't really matter because we tend to group ourselves with like-minded people, regardless of their heritage.
South Africa might not have jollof rice, but I would wager that we make a mean braai and we would compete with all of the African countries in that respect. Leon, are you an indoor person or an outdoor person?
I love the outdoors. I think living in Saudi Arabia and Dubai, I really miss Africa, particularly South Africa, because of the great outdoors. I think because of the heat out there in the desert, there's a lot of indoor activity. Even the outdoor paddle courts are air conditioned. But I love the outdoors. I love hiking in the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, going on trail runs. I think sport resilience is really interesting, because resilience is something that I believe you can develop along with emotional intelligence. It's like a muscle. So if you can build your resilience doing a triathlon, climbing up Lion's Head, doing a swim in the Midmar Dam, I think you carry those lessons into your professional workspace as well. So yeah, in answer to your question, very much an outdoor person, hence my love of South Africa.
Leon, beach or forest?
Oh, good question. I'd go for forest.
Why?
I suppose there's something... Is it the roads less travel? There's something mysterious about a forest. You can't quite see what's around the next corner. So full of intrigue, opportunity, perhaps like when you're starting out in your early career and you're not quite sure how things are going to pan out. Your life is full of possibility and wonder. And a forest can be like that. And particularly here in South Africa, I particularly enjoyed Knysna Forest and some of the forests down in Cape Town.
Leon, I want to take a look at perhaps some of the important lessons that you've learned along the way that perhaps you would want to impart on the next generation. If someone younger is looking to just understand a bit more around business and operating in different landscapes, what would you share as some pearls of wisdom?
I think in the African continent, it's really important that, you know, we cannot rely on governments or even big business to create livelihoods. We need leaders to create micro enterprises, SMEs like my business. But we need people to actually create opportunities by solving problems. And again, something I see around the world, less so here in Africa, but in other markets, is there can be an element of entitlement where people leave university and expect a red carpet to be rolled out to them and the corporate world is going to accept them. That's changing. I think you can always be preparing for being lucky. You know, so Gary Player says that the more I practice, the luckier I get. I think it's where preparation and opportunity interface is where we get the opportunity to really grab it. And it's going to be too late to learn how to do something when you get the opportunity. So preparation in terms of podcasts, reading, networking. You know, we might not all go to a fancy business school, but all that content is available online. So I would say constantly be preparing. I also think, for my children's generation that are leaving university now and just starting university, there's not going to be one career. They're going to have multiple careers, and that may involve several side hustles, which is going to require resilience, perhaps in a way that my parents could have one job for life and have a pension. So I think you're going to have to be entrepreneurial, innovative, resilient, really inquisitive, and really embrace a growth mindset.
Creating opportunities for problem solving, but also enjoying a sense of adventure. That is the managing partner at Sterling Bell, Leon Ayo. He joined me this week for our executive lounge.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of our conversations, please remember they are made available as a podcast so that you can catch up on them in your own time. But for right now, speaking of time, it is drawing near to the 7 o'clock mark, which means we're going to get ready to cross back to Chanduko Legege and the SAFM news team for the latest round of evening news. Of course, they will be followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. Final parting word from my side. I'm hoping that we get that interest rate cut from the United States and seeing what that does. But that's all I've got time for. 7 o'clock now. So from my side, good night.